right, everyone. It is Monday, December 16th, kind of cold and crisp outside. And you, of course, are tuned into The Attitude. And, of course, now you know the weather report in Concord, New Hampshire. So I'm exhausted. We had our holiday fundraising party for WNHN-FM over the weekend. And let me just say something. So I live in this old Queen Anne Victorian. The house has tremendous political history, everyone. I am so
beautiful, too.
It's a beautiful, beautiful old house. I inherited it. I don't have a pot to you know what in. But I inherited this house because of – it's a long story. But what's so great about the house is not only am I across the street from the Christom Colliffe Elementary School, but I can see all the pillars of the community from my third floor, which is where I live. I live in the old bat in the attic. And I can see the State House Dome. I can see the Christom McCullough School. I can see the Mary Baker Eddy Church steeple. I can see the Rudman Federal Courthouse. I mean, think about that. They are the pillars of your community. They really are. They're right there in front of me. And so
– and this community of Concord, New Hampshire doesn't have too many pillars. But those are them.
Exactly. So we had the fundraiser, and I decorated the house to the nines. And people came, and we had an amazing amount of food. And Amy Proctor, I love you. She used to live with me. She's the chief of staff for NHTI. And she did yeoman's work 2 days in a row. She helped me get ready because she knows I'm all by myself. But what we did do at the very, very end – at the very end of the evening, we had a duo that sang. And they went up to my third floor. Now, I have an open concept space in this old Victorian house, and it's very funky. It looks almost like a Soho loft. That's got that kind of feel to it. Anyway, so they performed, and they were standing in my bedroom entranceway, and everybody could see everybody in the space. And they just were – they were remarkable. Am I right, Ken? They were just – they were phenomenal.
The whole thing was remarkable. It was just such a warm and happy feeling of everybody who was there.
You just
Arnie
loved
did
everybody.
An amazing job. And then this band sounded more like the Moody Blues.
Moody Blues. I kept thinking, this is why I love this house. There's a musical performance happening in my attic. And it was – and think about this, everyone. And it was a remarkable musical performance. And everybody is smiling. We're all swaying and singing. And I'm looking. And it was just – it was like I am so lucky. I am so lucky. And I also got to bring people around the house because the house I mentioned is a very political house, an historic house. I mean, I really do have the Jimmy Carter bedroom where there's a plaque over the door and Jimmy Carter is thanking the former owner for letting him sleep there. I do have the Al Gore bathroom. It was the only room in the house that was a safe room that didn't have windows to the outside. I took them into what used to be the living room, and it was where Bill Clinton spoke and Bob Dole spoke and Jimmy Carter spoke. And it was just – I mean, so the house oozes, and Bernie Sanders began his campaign in my dining room in 2015. I mean, you walk around the house and you see the history of America. And then you walk around the house and you see this eclectic art. And then you walk around the house and there's music. There's a pianist on the first floor and there's a duo on the third floor. And everybody was baking. And it was just, it was the best of who we are as a country, I feel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I feel like
sure.
This is – if you want to know what America is, it's people coming together, caring about each other, sharing stories, sharing food, and sharing music. And we did it all in one afternoon.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted, totally exhausted, but so proud.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You should be proud. It was an amazing, amazing thing. I told Arnie before the show began, my wife said that it was the most enjoyable party she'd been to in a long time. It really just had this feeling of warmth and friendship and caring and community. And I have to tell you, everyone, Arnie's too modest to admit this, but the decorating there, which she all did, and the she made all these changes to the house. It's unbelievable how she designed whole rooms, and she broke down walls between rooms, and she put up
but all maintaining kinds the integrity of the house without
absolutely.
Ever hurting the integrity. I want everyone to understand this.
Absolutely,
I value this historic structure. Absolutely value.
Yeah, and she is a wonderful artist because the stuff she pulled together, she had art that she got from fire sales.
Oh, thrift stores, exactly.
And stuff that her aunt had left her that were real serious art and everything in between.
Yeah,
and it all went together, and she had this gorgeous wedding dress that she decorated with Christmas decorations.
Yes,
and
my Christmas tree.
Even more unbelievably gorgeous. It was something to behold. It really was something to behold.
Let me just say one really good quick thing. So an art teacher who apparently lives a couple blocks away, I didn't know her, but apparently she knows me from Facebook. So she came to the event, and she just could not stop smiling. And she said, we've got to figure out a way to bring students into here. Mm. We need to make this part of their art experience. And I feel like I won. I scored. That conversation made me happy because that's what I want to do. I want to expose children to art. I want them to understand what repurposing is. I want them to look at something for its texture and its color and say, how can we reuse this? Yeah. I want them. I don't care. So that if that happens, then it was the best event ever, because that's what I want to do. I want to thread a little bit of what I do with them, right. And then I can be the teacher. And that's the kind of teacher I want to be.
So absolutely.
Anyway, it was great. Yeah. Anyway, what's on your mind? There was a great story, by the way, about the Holocaust at Auschwitz, I think it was, in the New York Times. It's just over the weekend. I'll have to send it to you. I posted it on Facebook.
Okay.
Very emotional.
Okay. Well, yeah. There was also an amazing story about an amazing judicial opinion by Patty Saras from mm-hmm. the U.S. District Court in Boston.
Okay.
And it's fabulous. It's about immigration. Yep. And it's about bond hearings.
Bond hearings. Okay,
and when you hear the word bond, think bail. Because the immigration cases are not criminal cases, but it's like bail for mm-hmm. criminal cases. Mm-hmm. So if people come to the border and have an asylum, seek asylum and have a hearing pending in 2 years, mm-hmm. do they get incarcerated until then? Or do they get released and have to check in every now and then, mm-hmm. but actually get to have a life?
Right.
And I was appalled when I heard the immigration training talking about if you accompany someone to a bond hearing, the presumption is that you will be incarcerated. The presumption
right,
is you
right,
have to prove
right, right.
that you are not a danger or a flight risk.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to disappear and fail to show up for your hearing.
Gotcha.
And you're also not going to hurt anybody while you're out on bail or bond.
Right.
And the burden of proof was on the immigrant to prove a negative.
Exactly.
You know, how do you prove
do
that?
How exactly.
do you prove that?
Honest with to God, Judge, I've never done anything. I won't do anything now or in the
yeah.
future. I mean, how do you prove
How do you
that?
Do that in a credible
yeah.
way?
Exactly.
And unlike all other legal cases, criminal and civil, the burden is not on the plaintiff or the prosecutor to demonstrate that there is a reason to hold you in jail pending
right.
your hearing,
right.
you know?
Right.
So this decision by Judge Saras reversed that and said it's unconstitutional to have the burden of proof on the person to prove you shouldn't be detained. And it's fabulous because it makes a huge difference. I mean, obviously, to be released on your own recognizance and be out there mm-hmm. where you can get a job or be with your family or walk around in the fresh
right.
air, anything
right. – right.
is way better. But also the percentages are that if you're released on bond, you have a much, much better chance of being able to put together a case for your hearing
right,
and
right.
be prepared so that you can actually get asylum
right.
granted.
Now, who establishes the size of the bond? Is it just pro forma?
It's the immigration judge establishes mm-hmm. the size of the bond. And that was another thing that appalled me, Arnie, which yeah. I don't know if it's changed much. But I was told when I went down there with an ACLU lawyer
right.
that the bonds are $6,000 is a win for them to argue that the bond shouldn't be too high because people get ordered bonds of $12,000, $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
And who the heck can pay that?
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't get out.
What do we know about Americans?
Person.
Americans would have $400 in their account if there had been something in their home. The average American can't pay a bill of $400. So
yeah.
think about someone who's just fled a country coming up with the kind of bonds that you're talking about.
Right. So the other thing that Judge Saras did was she ordered that the immigration judges consider the individual's ability to pay.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
setting a bond amount above $1,500.
Wow.
So
okay.
it's an amazing decision. The ACLU deserves a lot of credit.
Thank you.
ACLU Massachusetts brought
We will have to definitely do that. That's
all,
a,
right.
A little bit more towards the direction of justice. Oh, my God, it's a novel idea. All right, joining us right now in studio.
The judges that are appointed make a difference, Arnie.
Well, I'm looking into the future, and it just looks bleak. It looks bleak. It is Monday, and joining us for our Rethink the Week in studio, as he does all the time, Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He also is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio for their end-of-the-week conversation, and he has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. And I want to welcome Dean back to the program. How are you, sir?
Hi, Ernie. I'm doing well.
Good, good, good. You missed a really good party on Sunday. I'm just telling you right now. It was so much. The music was over the top.
I've been in the past. It's always a good time.
It's always a good time.
I'm sorry I couldn't make it.
And we're going to be joined shortly by Glenn Smith. Glenn is a consultant. He worked with Ann Richards' campaign when she ran for governor. And he is a progressive from Texas. And, of course, because it is our Rethink the Week, there is so much, so much to talk about. You know, it's funny because you're here and we're still grabbing Glenn. Mm-hmm. I guess I want to talk a little bit about the fact that Julian Castro is on a tear. And he's on a tear because he thinks that the Democratic Party needs to rethink how we begin our presidential primary. Joining us right now is Glenn Smith from Texas. So let me bring Glenn in. Welcome to the program, Glenn. How are you?
Happy to be here, as always, Arnie. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. I already sort of told people you were coming and introduced you, so I won't do it again, Glenn. So I've been listening to Julian Castro complaining about New Hampshire and Iowa being the first of the nation primary and caucus states. And to a large extent, there's a bit of me that is very sympathetic with him. The Democratic Party has clearly changed, and it fits more with the changing demographic of America. You can understand that because, frankly, Texas should be the place where it begins, because Texas looks more like what America will look like in the next 2 or 3 years. But Iowa and New Hampshire are overwhelmingly white. New Hampshire is, the second oldest state in the nation, so it doesn't have a lot of young people. And it's also very, very wealthy. And Iowa is also somewhat of an aging state and also predominantly white. So I guess the question for you is, Dean, since you live in New Hampshire and he's challenging our ability to be in the first of the nation primary, is Julian right? Do we need a more diverse beginning in order to really reflect where the country is going and how we make informed choices?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've seen him on TV several times, and I've watched some video of him actually discussing this in front of Iowans.
Exactly.
Probably figures he doesn't have much to lose at this point. He's basically closed up shop here in New Hampshire.
Right.
You know, and it's interesting. I also heard of all people, Bill de Blasio defending the current system. And, you know, the argument as it currently exists is that you have these four contests that are in this pre-window prior to the beginning of March. And if you look at the combined demographics of all four taken together, it is a fairly reasonable representation of Democratic constituencies. The issue, obviously, that the case that Castro is making is that the first two are states that are you know, between 91 and 95% white in terms of their populations, and that in theory, you know, that sets up certain candidates with an advantage going into the subsequent contest. You know, if you look at Nevada polling in Nevada, which is the third state, and South Carolina, which is the fourth state, you know, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are doing well in those states also. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not as though there's some odd split where, you know, Julian Castro, Cory Booker and others are doing well in Nevada and South Carolina, and Biden and Sanders are doing well in the white states. You know, this is something I get asked every 4 years, as you well know, Arnie, because you're a veteran of Democratic politics. This is something that has been fought over for several decades, with varying levels of intensity and potential threat to the primary. You know, I don't really know what the answer is. The problem is that this is all driven by individual states. You know, the states set their calendars. The DNC can try to incentivize certain kinds of behavior, which they did. If you remember back, I think maybe it was all the way back in 2008, which was the last time there was a serious discussion about this. A couple states stepped out of line, and the DNC, you know, sanctioned them and said they weren't going to seat their delegates in the convention. And what always happens is the winning nominee says, no, we'll seat you. It's okay. So it's kind of self-perpetuating, right? The people who are benefiting from the current system, if they win, they have no incentive not to perpetuate it. And the people who feel like like Julian Castro, who feel like they're not getting a fair shake as a result, you know, complain. You know, Castro, the only thing that I found a little troubling about, and you probably saw him this morning on Morning Joe, he was on for close to 20 minutes, was he kept talking about, you know, New Hampshire and Iowa not representing the values of the Democratic Party.
Oh, I think that's
not an issue of values.
It isn't.
It's an issue of demographics.
Right.
You know,
so,
New Hampshire and Iowa have turned out very progressive winners. Bernie Sanders is
exactly,
tremendously progressive.
Exactly.
So I understand his point. It's a thicket that I try to, as an analyst, I try to avoid wading into as much as possible. But I understand it quite well, and I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe he's right that we've reached some point of no return.
But if
Biden or Sanders or some other candidate wins or Buttigieg, in part because they got momentum out of Iowa and New Hampshire, they're going to want to lock the system in for another 4 years.
So Glenn, there's a piece of me, and I've been living in New Hampshire since 1980. I have either been involved in politics or involved in sort of political primaries, like presidential primaries, since 1992. So right after I lost my race for governor is when I suddenly got sort of swept away into all the presidential politics. It sort of defines my state. So Glenn, I understand the resentment. I really do. And I can understand that there is a changing demographic. Texas is much more representative of really the country that we are going to be than New Hampshire and Iowa probably ever will. I mean, let's be honest here. And my question is, do we create a greater sense of trust with the changing demographic if we start with a state that is more representative of the changing demographic? And one of the reasons I even say that, and part of that changing demographic, is there's a new article out at Governing Magazine about why do presidential candidates never talk about urban issues? Think about that. And they don't. So, and I'm looking at Texas going, think of all your large urban areas in Texas. Not only do you have the right demographic for the future, you even have like big cities, which are very representative of where we are going as a nation.
I think it would be far preferable if we started in more diverse states without saying anything bad about New Hampshire or Iowa. But I do want to make this point. We'd have to take these things in context. Like one of the problems is caused by the amount of momentum given a winner in the Iowa caucuses. It's not treated as a limited caucus with a limited, you know, geographically limited anyway vision in terms of establishing who's going to win, you know, the Belmont long race, right? Mm-hmm. So part of it is like the spin skews the results. If that didn't happen so much, if it wasn't
That's
such horse
true.
Race coverage in the media, people wouldn't complain about it. Also, one other point about Julian's frustration, and I think everybody is frustrated with what the National Democratic Party did with regard to the debates, and it set these things up where people had to beat the person in front of them. We've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I myself am very frustrated with it. I think it knocked off good candidates and gave advantage to some other candidates, and it made all of our candidates look a little, I don't know, less than spectacular. I just have not been a fan of this debate schedule and the way they run them and the way they've measured who gets in or out. And I think Julian's frustration also comes from that.
So let me just say one more thing. And I think, you know what, unintentionally, and again, this is part of the problem, is until we fix money in politics, in a bizarre way, what they did was set it up for Bloomberg. I mean, I just think there are so many people that are so frustrated with what they had to do and what they had to thread, the polling, the amount of money from all these different states. And what Bloomberg can do, and everyone says, let's be honest, Dean, what is the most dissatisfying part of a presidential campaign? The debates. I mean, what do you learn in a debate? No, let's be serious here. What do you learn? Zippo.
I've been very consistent about this over the years.
Oh.
I think there's way too much over-interpretation of these debates. I think the impact is usually transitory. I don't like debates with 10, 11, 12 people on the stage. You know, if they really wanted to bring in more people, if it was really essential that, you know, Marianne Williamson still be on the stage, then maybe split it up into 2 days. But
like the Republicans did.
If there's a consensus that it's that much of an issue, the DNC is doing this in part because if you remember back not too long ago, everybody and their first cousin was having a debate. There were literally something like 25 or 30. You know, MSNBC wanted theirs, and then CNN had one, and then the League of Women Voters.
And then the Des Moines Register.
Everybody,
and then,
AARP had them. And it just got to be literally there was a debate like every 2 weeks. And so this was an attempt to kind of take back control of the process. Debbie Wasserman Schultz got a lot of criticism the last time because we were watching Bernie Sanders on Saturday night up against the NFL playoffs, which was which he was very upset about in December. So, I think there has to be other ways for people to engage. I think a lot of the town halls that the cable channels have been doing
have been
helpful. If you really want to learn about somebody, you can watch them. But the debates, I just think, are just too much emphasis.
Yeah, can I just add an aspect, and I guess direct the question first to Glenn? I tend to agree with you that it would be better to start with more representative, more diverse states. But if you had the first primaries in places like Texas, then could you get the kind of retail politics which New Hampshire and Iowa actually give? And it's a real service to the public to get candidates speaking in small venues to real people, you know, not staged with questions only asked by MSNBC hosts or whoever it is, and have some back and forth where you can follow up your question.
But couldn't you do that? Wait, let me just ask a question. Didn't Beto O'Rourke give speeches in every single county in Texas? Didn't Beto O'Rourke make himself incredibly available when he ran for the U.S. Senate? So the idea that only retail politics can exist in Iowa and New Hampshire is a bit of a fiction because I can just look at Beto. Am I wrong here, Glenn, or did I imagine that Beto did retail?
That's good.
No, but the question points, I think, to another issue, which was the size and the expense of running a race in a state the size of Texas, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's awfully expensive to do it, and so it might, it might give the advantage to the better fundraiser or to the self-funding candidates over just because of the cost.
Exactly.
That's a danger. On the other hand, fundraising has changed so radically in the last 3 cycles that maybe that advantage is overestimated. So I think the retail side of things, I don't think you'd see it. You might even see more people turn out to see him in those sort of more casual settings and fair-like settings where they got to talk to people and shake hands.
Yeah. Let me just go real quickly. We're going to be talking more about this on the across the break. But Dean, as we were talking about, you know, how successful Bernie Sanders is, and there's a new poll out. It's Biden and Bernie in the new polls. But of course, what now Bernie has sort of shadowing over him is what just happened in the UK with the incredible win by Boris Johnson. I mean, incredible. And they're looking at the Labour Party, and they're kind of going, arrivederci, Labour. So I'm kind of – is it even close to fair to compare Boris Johnson's win and the potential for Trump to win? Because Boris looks so much like Donald Trump. Boris, to some extent, acts a little bit like Donald Trump. But I think that the comparison between the two is actually wrong. And maybe I'm naive here, but I'm kind of curious as to what you think.
Well, I mean, there's certainly people other than me who could give you a deeper read of British politics. But my sense is that And this was my expectation that the results in Great Britain are being used in both ways. Some people are saying, see, well, you know, I've already seen a number of people, James Carville, a number of other prominent Democratic operatives who have said, see, you know, you go with Bernie Sanders, you go with Elizabeth Warren,
that's
it's
right.
going to be just
give
like
us moderates.
Jeremy
give
Corbyn,
us moderates.
All, it's going to be Jeremy
moderates.
Corbyn all over again. And I've seen others make the argument like you who are, you know, European conservative populism and the dynamics of politics in that part of the world is just fundamentally different. The nature of the political system, the way parties function is different. So I don't feel like I'm in a position to give you a decisive read one way or the other, but it was clear to me as soon as I saw what happened that it would be used in both directions, that we would hear moderates jump on this and say, aha, look, see, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, this is where we're headed, Jeremy Corbyn.
All right, Glenn, really quickly, I really want to continue this conversation only because I know what Boris Johnson ran on and I know what Jeremy Corbyn didn't run on, and it's actually so dissimilar. But I'm kind of curious what you think, Glenn.
Oh, I agree with you. I don't think the similarities are there, frankly. I mean, Corbyn ran a terrible race.
Couldn't decide
where he was on Brexit.
Yes.
He's an unlikable guy in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And really one other point. We have months to go before the election here. And in the environment we're in, heavens knows what we're going to confront, see what's going to happen. I mean, this is an election across the pond a year out from ours, and I just don't take many lessons from it.
And
another thing, by the way, is that Corbyn, I think, was more like Trump in his
anti-Semitism,
in his humanism. You know, he's really a nasty kind of guy.
Yeah, and let me just say one other thing. Let's not forget, what does England have that we don't? A welfare state. What did Boris Johnson promise for the National Health Service? Billions of pounds or millions of pounds of extra money to make the National Health Service single-payer health care, everyone. Even better, what a lefty he is. And he also promised lots of infrastructure in the more rural parts of England that have really been denied that infrastructure investment. Donald Trump doesn't give a crap about health care. Donald Trump hasn't spent a dime on any infrastructure yet except for his wall, which is a fiction. So in a lot of ways, when you look at what Boris packaged, he packaged Brexit. He was a better candidate. He offered more money for health care. He offered more money for infrastructure. And to a large extent, if you look at some of those things, I mean, at least the Democrats have a position and they are talking health care and they are talking infrastructure. So to a bizarre extent, Boris pulled a page out of Bernie's campaign more than Jeremy Corbyn. Am I wrong here, Glenn?
No, you got it exactly right. I mean, but I don't even take – I'm not even going to take a lesson from that. I mean,
I know you're going
to say
it.
I think it's a radically different election system, a radically different time. We're not faced with, you know, Scotland going independent, Ireland having a hard border. There's so many things that aren't the deal. I just don't think you can compare
it. And last but not least, I did see a headline from one of the Metro papers in England about how a lot of Muslims are now figuring out how they can leave England. That they're so worried about the election of Boris Johnson that they're looking for ways to find a new home. That was the headline. That is a really frightening one. See, that's what I see will happen if Donald Trump wins again. I think that headline becomes our headline as well. And on that note, this is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is our Monday Rethink the Week. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1951. That was the day New York City was struck by the Great Bagel Famine. 300 members across 32 bakeries of the Bagel Bakers of America Local 338 walked off the job over wages and working conditions. Morris Siegel, business agent for the local, stated that the Bakers Association had been lax in living up to the welfare fund payments and sanitary provisions of the contract. The Bagel Bakers produced 1.2 million bagels weekly for New York City consumers. The Wisconsin Jewish Chronicle noted, quote, "The only ones welcoming this respite are the salmon. Diners, delicatessens, and Teamster delivery drivers were all rocked by the strike, which lasted for 6 weeks. The two sides were so deadlocked that a mediator who had effectively settled a smoked salmon dispute 3 years earlier was brought in to help settle the conflict. The Bagel Bakers won a $3 a day wage increase and were ready to return to work. But the Teamsters would not begin deliveries until they were paid for lost wages due to the lack of deliveries made during the strike. The Bagel Bakers would engage in job actions effectively over the course of the next 15 years until they, too, suffered the fate of many an industrial worker, that of automation. Their labor would eventually be replaced by labor-saving bagel-making machines by the late 1960s.
The Bagel Bakers Local 338 was a union that was based in New York State, and they set the minimum wages of the Yiddish bagel bakeries and controlled all of the stages from the flour sack to the plate. But like the railroad to the canal.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Natural gas consists mainly of methane, a potent global warming pollutant. So to help hold companies accountable for letting methane pollution escape to the atmosphere, the Environmental Defense Fund is doing more than lobbying legislators. It's sending a satellite into orbit.
That will allow us to look at every single major oil and gas facility around the world multiple times per week.
EDF President Fred Krupp says these facilities often have malfunctioning equipment or pipes that allow methane to leak. Many of these problems can be fixed, and the repairs often pay for themselves because they help reduce the amount of gas that's wasted. The International Energy Agency reports that companies can eliminate almost half of their methane pollution.
At no net cost.
But Krupp says, by and large, companies have not taken adequate action.
You have to monitor this, and the industry so far has not been monitoring for this pollution.
So EDF has partnered with an aerospace company to build a satellite that will locate and monitor leaks. He says companies will know where the problems are, and the public can hold them responsible. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Oh, I want to play all of this song. All right. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. The name of this song, totally perfect for our next conversation because I got the headline from The Hill right in front of me, is entitled Under Pressure by Monsieur?
By Queen, the fabulous Queen.
God, do I love Queen. Oh, I have to thank my husband because I was totally oblivious to Queen until he turned me on to it. I'm like, who is this group? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. All right. This is our Rethink the Week. In studio is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University and a regular in our studio. Joining us from that great demographically changing Texas is Glenn Smith. So, Glenn, give me exactly like a one sentence. Like, how do I describe you? I'm just keeping, you know, I mean, I know you worked at Ann Richards' campaign. I know you do progressive politics. I know you've been a reporter. But how does Glenn describe Glenn?
Is a reprobate, but a happy one.
A happy one. Well, there, I describe myself as a politician in recovery, so we're the same. A reprobate. Well, forget it, then. I'll use my old version of how I describe Glenn. So I'm looking at a headline from The Hill, and it was from this morning. Judiciary panel explains impeachment charges. Trump has realized the framers' worst nightmare. So I will start with you, Glenn. I was talking to Dean during the break, and I said, you know what the problem with this impeachment, and we know we're going to vote on it this week, and then we're going to send it over to the Senate, is that I feel like every hour of Donald Trump's reign as president, and I'm going to call it a reign, feels like it's been an impeachable act. Just everything he does is impeachable to me. I mean, we're just talking about the fact he didn't know where Seoul was in South Korea in relationship to the border of North Korea. I think he's impeachable because he has no geography. I mean, that's just like, I think he's impeachable because he's got that damn football with the nuclear codes, and you know he's so crazy that he could like you know do it in a second, and he could like send it to the wrong country because he doesn't know geography. I mean, it's just like so. And the problem is, we get to this impeachable moment, and I'm like, okay. And it, in a way, it lands like a thud, a little bit like the Mueller report, because we are so exhausted by his over the top actions that don't even have anything that has a relationship to integrity, to honesty, to thoughtfulness, to compassion, to policy, that this just feels like another day in the park.
Well, there's something to that. I mean, that's the number one tactic of authoritarians.
Yes.
I'm increasingly just using the term fascist to apply to Trump and McConnell and them because they're headed toward, they're breaking every possible rule and standard that they can. So, but then in the end, it argues for the more focused or limited, let's say, articles of impeachment in this case, because it's less noisy. It's not perfect by any means. It's like you say, there are so many different things we could explore and do articles on. I mean, there could be 100. There could be 200.
Yeah.
But that's noisy, and that plays into their hands. So it's intentionally causing the sort of psychic damage, the paralyzing people, shutting down people's minds, confusing people. And so that's a pretty good argument for what they've done. And I don't think they had any choice but to impeach in the House, given that what he had done in this instance was basically try to bribe or extort a foreign power to intervene in the U.S. election on his behalf. And they can't let that stand.
Yeah.
They can't shrug that off, because that becomes a precedent of foreign involvement in American elections like we've never really had before.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just read you a sentence from the 658-page report. Your nighttime reading, everyone. Quote, taken together, the articles charge that President Trump has placed his personal political interests above our national security, our free and fair elections, and our system of checks and balances. He has engaged in a pattern of misconduct, and here are the operative words, everyone, write these on your refrigerator door, that will continue if left unchecked. This is the problem, Dean Spiliotis. It's not that what he did was wrong. It's that he doesn't even – he revels in the wrong. And he says, if you think this is wrong, watch my next wrong. And if you think my next wrong is wrong – and he also has the incredible chutzpah that he thinks that if somehow he does it literally on Fifth Avenue or on TV or with the cameras blaring, that it can't be wrong because I'm doing it in public and you're seeing it. So how could this be wrong if you're seeing it?
Well, and they made that argument all along. As long as he's been in the office, they've been arguing that, look, as long as you do it out in public, it's not ill intent, or I can't remember what the exact legal phrase is, malicious intent or something like that. He is how he is. I've never seen a lot of kind of strategic thinking or tactical behavior. It's very visceral, and he's going to continue to react. He thinks that, we talked about this years ago, that he basically has kind of turned the daily functioning of the White House into a version of his family business.
Yeah.
Only people around him that he trusts that are, blindly loyal to him, a small number of people.
Right.
He doesn't want independent decision makers. He doesn't want to have to deal with a lot of conflict.
Right.
People say he likes chaos and kind of conflict around him. But in the end, he's the decision maker, and he eliminates people who consistently push back against him.
Well, let me just say something to you. So, Glenn, as I'm listening to the chaos, he likes chaos, but not around him in his teeny tiny orbit.
Yeah, right.
His teeny tiny orbit. And it keeps shrinking, Glenn, because now when he has calls with international leaders, the number of people who can listen in on the calls.
It'll just be Jared and
it'll be Jared and Ivanka. I mean, it's going to be who can't even translate, but it doesn't even matter. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, and that's part of the problem is that this isn't about policy. It isn't about chaos. It's about the fact that he has just decided that there are no checks and balances. And remember Leona, what was her name? Helmsley, who said that only little people pay taxes. Well, I've just decided only little people have to have integrity. I think you fail upwards in Donald Trump's world.
I mean, we just to keep in mind with him that he truly is a like super narcissist. I mean, he doesn't. Everything is about him. Everything comes back to him. I was laughing at that great song in the Broadway show and movie The Producers, where Hitler sings "Heil Myself."
That's a great song. That's right.
That's what Trump is. Everything he does is "Heil Myself," and so he doesn't need anybody else around him. And it's all a question of who he's going to trust. 1 hour to the next, and that's why it keeps limiting him down to just the family who he has some control over, because they want to inherit what's ever in his name. So we've never had anybody like him, and that's why he's so dangerous, really. It's not ideological, but most fascists aren't ideological. They're all narcissists. They're all about personal power, and he's like a perfect sort of symbol of it.
Yeah,
I just want to jump in. What fascinates me is in trying to understand what his behavior and what he might do in the future. I went to graduate school in the mid-late 1980s at a time where psychological interpretations of presidential behavior, a focus on individual temperament and psychology and you know, prior experiences.
How yesterday.
All of that stuff was very frowned upon. What you learned was that all presidents enter office. There's a certain set of incentives. There's a certain institutional dynamic that constrains them and shapes their behavior in certain ways. And what's so interesting here to me is he's really testing all of that because time and again, the typical institutional barriers, the typical kind of standard operating procedures, conventions of the offices, respect for certain types of institutional dynamics just isn't there. So we really are talking about kind of the individual in a way that I have not really seen. And I'm fascinated in my lifetime, really. And I'm interested to see how political scientists grapple with the model of institutions and incentives not really applying.
I think we created him, Glenn. And I'm going to tell you how we created him. We created him because now the amount of money that now can flow into campaigns, money that we see, money that we don't, it's invited outside money. And I mean outside the 50 states. How do you know what an LLC is getting its money from? How do you know what this is? I mean, the idea of transparency is just out the window. The idea of limits is just out the window. So have an overwhelming inequality around the world. Have people like Putin, who are probably sitting on trillions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, and we already know that they start making interesting investments, okay, whether it's a farm investment, a real estate investment, or whatever, and then an LLC crops up in Iowa, and you think it's coming from an Iowa farmer, and you might find out that it's coming from a Saudi official. You know, you don't know. And that was intentional. We have now made sure that the money comes through in any way, shape, or form, and if there is a crack, billions will flow through, number one. That money is our problem. Our second problem is gerrymandering. The reason why Donald Trump is so successful is he's got the Republican Party by the balls. That's what he's got him by, because they have to win a primary. And you and I both know that in gerrymandered primaries, 16 people show up to vote. They're usually the most extreme 16 you could probably find in that district. And they're so designed that the general election has no meaning. So there is no desire to be a reasonable, rational person who understands checks and balances and wants to put a control over the president and understands policy. It's basically a gerrymandered system that creates people that say, yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, sir. No, sir. I'll do whatever you want, sir. And that's exactly what happened. And then we get a Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is using all those levers to his advantage. And he is our creation. We own him, Glenn.
Well, I don't know where to start to answer that. Those are two huge topics.
They are huge.
I do want to say that they're probably – one of the most myopic Supreme Court decisions of all time had to be Citizens United.
Yeah.
And the lines in the majority opinion about how there will be no appearance of corruption, et cetera, et cetera. How could they have been more wrong than that?
Yes.
I know from experience here, by the way, and you touched on this in your question, that there are plenty of foreign-owned companies with subsidiaries, including Russia's, one of the top one in Texas, especially around the port of Houston. They have American subsidiaries with American citizens' employees, and those citizens legally give money, mostly here, to Republican candidates, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really Russian money flowing legally to an American subsidiary and American citizens to the candidates Russia wants to give the money to.
Right.
What do you do about that? Like you say, we know it's hard to follow it, because you don't really know, you know, the precise source of the money. On redistricting, the fact that we've let this happen is just an embarrassment. I mean, it's. I mean, 500 years from now, gerrymandering is going to be seen as something that toppled one of the most successful democracies in world history. I mean,
500 years? I'll give you 50, baby. I'm telling you, 500 is way too long.
Yeah, but in 50 years, they may not allow historians to write about it. We got to get past the fascist era before historians can actually address it. So it may take longer than 50. We ought to have independent commissions do it.
Yes.
It's ridiculous. I live in Austin, Texas, which is theoretically one of the more liberal cities in all of America. We don't have a congressman, right? There is a place you can stand in Austin, Texas, with four different congressional districts that have a sliver of Austin, and then go out and grab a lot of Republican votes. That's how they disenfranchise people.
Yeah, and it is a form of disenfranchise. Dean.
Yeah, well, you know, whenever I teach this topic and discuss it with my students in class, we talk about two things, and one is the role of money, which mm-hmm. you've talked about. The other is the impact of technology. If you go back and look at the founders, they were very concerned that the president be somewhat insulated from the volatility of the daily political discourse. Mm-hmm. And in the late 1700s, you could insulate a president pretty easily because you didn't have the ease of technology that you now have. And really, starting in the 20th century, you know, first with the radio and then television and now digital media, presidents have more and more directly engaged voters. And, you know, some people think that's a good thing. It's more plebiscitary. It's more small D democratic. But it also introduces a lot of volatility in the system. And in some sense, you know, Trump and Twitter really is kind of the highest realization of the fears at this point, where literally everything is driven by the direct, somewhat kind of volatile daily discourse on right. social media. And you know, the founders were very concerned about that. They had a whole theory of human behavior that said if you insulate an individual, they're more likely to behave in virtuous ways. And then as the circle of access gets more bigger and more immediate, right. you're subject to kind of volatility. And it's kind of what we see now. We have a very volatile, toxic political discourse in the country.
So let me ask you a question. Sandy Levinson, who I think you know from, I think he teaches in Houston. He's a law professor. He really talks about the fault lines in the Constitution, Glenn. Given everything you just heard from Dean, given everything we've just talked about with the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court decisions, we talk about how we value this constitutional document. Does this constitutional document fit? Does it work today? I mean, I go back to something very interesting. South Africa, when they rewrote their constitution, this is an interesting little nugget of information, everyone. Because they had just gone through apartheid, okay, in a fairly recent amount of time, when they decided, although they don't necessarily live up to those ideals, when they decided to make the idea of discrimination illegal in their constitution, they included discrimination in all forms, including sexual preference. All right? Think about that. Now, that was not in our constitution. In fact, you know, I mean, think about what we did in ours, and then think about what South Africa realized after having lived through apartheid. Is part of our problem, our constitutional document, which supposedly is the controlling document, now failing us?
Well, I think it certainly can point to some things like the Electoral College, which was there to serve a particular purpose of the times and is now serving almost a reverse purpose.
Yes.
I myself kind of have a problem with the federal judges appointed for life. That's another problem. I see it's a problem anyway. But theoretically, the framers thought this would be a living document that we would have an easier time
right.
changing to match
right.
changing circumstances as the decades went by. That's turned out not to be as easy as we thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for instance, the failure of the Equal Rights Amendment is another like black mark in our history. Now, how could that fail to be ratified when you think about it on the face? It's
Phyllis Schlafly, I love you. Oh my God, that's all I think about is Phyllis. Every time you say ERA, isn't that terrible? When you say ERA, what comes into my mind? Not equal rights, but Phyllis Schlafly, who was the queen of trying to kill it. It's terrible. It's terrible. We only have a few minutes left. I have to talk about this because I saw this story and it just so relates to the conversation we're having. And it includes Texas, which is why I love it, Glenn. But I'm going to go to Dean with the title. Joe Biden told a protester at his Texas campaign rally that he's just like Donald Trump for asking about corruption in Ukraine. And I think this is a Joe Biden problem, Dean Spiliotis. I think Joe Biden still has not figured out how to sort of talk about his son Hunter, who has a drug problem, who had a financial problem, who, when you look at his sketchy portfolio, is so questionable, including his decision to work for this company in Ukraine, especially while his father was tasked with Ukraine. He has not been able to answer this question, and he is not sounding like Donald Trump? Because trust me, some Democrats are saying that, and the impeachment hearing is going to bring this up when they go to the U.S. Senate 24/7, because Mitch McConnell is going to control it. Lindsey Graham is going to be there asking lots of questions. And trust me, it's going to be Biden, Hunter, Ukraine almost every other hour.
You know, I don't know if this is the same clip where he told the guy to get your facts straight, Jack. That was another.
That was Iowa.
That's what I thought. I have not read this one yet. I will say, and I think I said on the earlier episode that, you know, he needs to have a better way of discussing this. Oh. You know, simply saying that, you know, he's an adult. I was not involved with it. He makes his own decisions is not sufficient. And it's only going to ramp up if he becomes the nominee. That this seems to be the one potential vulnerability that Republicans think they have, other than the, you know, kind of sleepy Joe. He's losing a little bit of losing a step argument, and they're just going to keep hitting it, and we'll see that they Donald Trump had said they were going to have Hunter Biden and Joe Biden at the impeachment.
That's
not likely. I know that Chuck Schumer has just asked for Mulvaney and
what's with the mustache?
Bolton Mulvaney, and two others. We don't know if there are going to be any witnesses, but. Unless Biden comes up with a better answer for this, and you know, Hunter Biden did that interview, and it sort of is what it is. You know, I don't know how he deals with it, but it's going to, you know, no matter what he does, this is going to be with him through the election.
Well, can I ask why this issue hasn't hurt Biden with the voters? Why he's still at the top of the polls? This seems to me to be more troublesome to most voters than Elizabeth Warren's
healthcare
disaster plan. Not being able to explain how she's going to pay for Medicare for all in that one debate, you know, and she just plummeted like a rock at that point. And Biden is saying these ridiculous things and refusing to own up to anything. And
so Glenn's a consultant in the family. So Mr. Consultant, political consultant, let's talk a little bit about this Biden, Joe, Biden, Hunter, Biden, Ukraine, Biden, Trump. And let's talk about this, because I think this is really a level of vulnerability. And right now, maybe the Democrats are trying to protect Joe, so they don't want to have sort of a come to Jesus moment on it. But once Joe becomes the nominee, how do you protect him when he doesn't have a satisfying answer? And people in America are going to know more about Joe Biden and Ukraine than they're going to know about Joe Biden and Barack Obama.
Well, one of the reasons that it's not hurting him in the polls is not that all of, you know, voters are rallying around him, or consultants are protecting him, or the powers that be in D.C. are protecting. It's like we've already divided up into two camps. So it's not hurting Trump that he tried to bribe a foreign power to intervening in our election on his behalf. And it's not hurting Biden that his son might have had an inappropriate job in the Ukraine. So I don't know what. I'm surprised that Biden has held as strong as he has generally, even without this Hunter issue. That surprises me. And I think it's going to get more volatile before it settles out. I think it's African-American base. They're sticking with him in the national polls, that he's still doing well in the early primary states. It's somewhat of a surprise to me, and maybe more of a function of the sort of like, I don't know, there's sort of like 20-some candidates to start with, and people are confused, and maybe they're not totally happy with any of them at the moment. I want to say one more thing about the Bidens in the Ukraine. I am too worried about that issue, but it has nothing. It doesn't come close to comparing to what Trump has done
behalf of
Russia and in Ukraine. And it gets talked about in the press as if they're sort of like equivalent scandals.
Yeah.
No. Let me just say something.
In the worst case, the Biden's.
Okay. Let me just say something. Let me just say something. Hold on, everyone. Here's the problem. The problem is, how many people knew about Ukraine before this happened? Nobody. Until you saw the shakedown of the new Ukrainian president, until we heard about Hunter Biden, most people couldn't even spell Ukraine. We are so xenophobic anyway, we don't know it. The problem is that there's too many things that are bizarre about this that sound the same. I just hate to break it to you. That's the problem. I understand the results are very different. I used this analogy the other day. Listen to this, Dean. So you're driving up a highway, and the highway says, Ukraine, corruption highway. Biden's on that, so's Trump on that. And then all of a sudden the highway diverges. Well, one diverges where you shake down the president so that they basically look into the, you know, the kind of corruption with Joe Biden. And then you've got the Biden Ukraine, and Biden is going to the Ukrainian president. You've got to clean up the corruption in Ukraine. Otherwise, we're not going to give you aid. And he is generic in it. It isn't just about one company or one prosecutor. It's about the notorious Ukrainian system, which is so, so corrupt. And the problem is that most people don't get to the divide. They're on the highway and they hear the same words being used about both. And I would love the level of sophistication, but people don't even read newspapers. You think they're going to get into the weeds about the fact that these are so different. It's really hard. Dean, it's hard. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you. And I'm not being naive here. I do a lot of commercial radio, and I get attacked all the time. And one of the guys that attacked me last Friday gave the most eloquent description of what he thought Joe Biden did, and it sounded so reasonable because it had 90% of the facts, but it's that last 10% that makes all the difference, and we never really got there. And that's what's so scary about this. And it's not scary for Joe in the primary, apparently, but it's going to be a really scary thing in a general election.
No, absolutely, and I don't anticipate it changing at all for him should he be the nominee. Trump has been very successful at kind of going back to familiar themes all over and over again, and to the extent that they can set this up as some sort of an equivalency in terms of the facts on the ground, that's to their advantage tactically.
Absolutely. And in the end, I'm going to end with this, Glenn. You know who's going to benefit the most from this? Not Donald Trump. Not Joe, not any of the other Democratic candidates except for one, Mayor Bloomberg. You watch. Mayor Bloomberg is going to do what nobody else can do because he's not going to have any of the Ukrainian liability or son liability of Biden. And he ran a bigger city than Mayor Pete. Okay, and he's good on guns, and he's good on public health,
and he's got the mayor's skin like almost no one else because he's wealthier.
And exactly, and he can spend $1 billion and not feel it. So I am telling you,
he also has
some
baggage from his
running. Yeah, but so does Joe. He's got the same baggage practically.
Right.
And
right.
On that note, Glenn Smith, thank you for joining us, Mike.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh yeah. If we can't solve the problem on Monday, who can? All right, everyone, take care. Talk to you soon. All right, we're going to end with. Monsieur?
Well, we're going to end with who can solve the problem. Give more power to the people.
Oh, I like
by the Shylands.
Very good. For God's sake, give more power to the people. There's some people up there hogging everything. Telling lies, giving out a bad about the people's money and things.